You remind me of the babe.
What babe?
The babe with the power.
What power?
The power of voodoo.
Voodoo?
You do.
What?
Remind me of the babe.
Hiroshima.
Hello, Jellyheads, and welcome to another exciting episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. I am your host, David Halstead, with my other host...
Luke, the wonderful Wilson.
And who's with us today?
Hi. I'm Aaron.
I'm Cal.
Aaron, you're back.
I'm allowed to be back. I'm not here. Ignore me!
You haven't been on the show in forever.
I mean, it's been a while.
It was like early last year.
I occasionally show up to say hi. Hi, I'm gonna go now.
Well, I had to have you guys on this show. Because uh-oh. This movie is a movie I've talked about with you, specifically Cal, before.
Cal's never been on the show before.
Nope.
It is one of the movies I grew up with. Have watched I do not know how many times.
And I just watched it for the first time.
I'm very curious to hear what it was like to watch Labyrinth for the first time as an adult, because I don't think I have a full ability to analyze it, having watched it repeatedly as a child.
I saw it. As a child, at some point, I know that I watched it all the way through as a child, but I can't really remember a whole lot of it besides shots of the maze from far away. And that was like it. And then I saw like the beginning of it in college, and this is the first time I've like really watched it and been able to remember.
I know that I watched it for the first time when I was 9, actually. Because at the time, I have a baby brother. Who was an infant at the time when I was first watching this. So I actually, the very first time I started watching it as a 9-year-old, found it a little bit alarming and was kind of upset about the idea of a baby brother being stolen away. But we did have a copy, and I've watched it a lot of times.
Wait a minute, you had a copy of your brother?
No, a copy of the movie.
I was worried about my little brother being stolen away, but we had a copy.
We could just import the new brother.
You know, clones. If one blows up, you just bring in a clone, get the backup.
Well, I don't think we've said what movie we're discussing,
so
actually.
Sounds like the Venture Brothers.
But this is the show where we discuss the strange, the obscure, the bee, the cult, bad, and sometimes classic films. And tonight we're discussing Labyrinth.
Which is, of course, a wonderful and awesome film.
Starring David Bowie's crotch. And David Bowie, too, from my understanding.
David Bowie's hair also plays an important role. Let's be fair here. And it was one of the first sightings of David Bowie's shape-shifting abilities.
Yes.
Also, one of the brilliance of casting him is they actually can walk upside down on walls.
Yeah, yeah. It
legendary
helps.
Man.
It
saved him so money. Much on practical effects that he could just do that. The ball juggling, that was another guy, though.
Oh, yeah, I mean, he couldn't do that.
You know, everybody's got something they can't do.
Right.
For Bowie, it just happened to be contact juggling.
Everything else, though, I mean, he had turning into the owl down pat, stealing babies. He apparently
Cradle
had
Robert.
Done that earlier in his life, so. all the magic, totally just, yep, he got that.
I was a little weirded out when I looked up online that Jennifer Connelly was like 14 when she did this. It's like, wow. This was like Jennifer Connelly's like third or fourth movie, wasn't it?
I have no clue. I haven't. Have you seen her in other movies?
Before this, she was in Once Upon a Time in America, the Sergei Leone gangster film.
Huh.
Which is interesting because next week we're going to be discussing Once Upon a Time in the West.
Hmm.
But that was her first film. After that, she was in this Dario Argento Italian horror film called Phenomena.
Oh, God. That thing.
What brought her to Italian films?
I don't really understand her career, because she just happened to be cast in, like, major films. She's also one of those actresses who really has never gone away and has always been doing, like, major pictures since she was a teenager.
What's she done lately?
I'm failing to think of other.
Like, she does movies today that she's won Academy Awards for recently.
We are going to need to look this up. To the land of the internets.
She was in Noah. Probably the last one you remember.
Requiem for a Dream, A Beautiful Mind.
Who was she in Requiem?
I don't know. I never saw that movie.
You know, that's probably
Marion Silver.
That movie's full of nightmare fuel anyways.
But she's still a very recognizable name, you know.
Oh, God.
Unfortunately,
part in Requiem. Oh, my God. I'm sorry, I just saw her face again and it clicked.
Well, it's one of those things, like, a lot of actresses, unfortunately, are only around for, like, a short period of time, and then they become obscure. So anyways, I'm going to start us off with a little summary of Labyrinth I wrote here. Labyrinth is a 1986 fantasy adventure film from Jim Henson, which stars Jennifer Connelly and David Bowie. And his crotch. Connelly plays a young woman obsessed with fantasy and theater who's forced to spend the night home babysitting her baby brother. After about 2 minutes of babysitting, she wishes the goblins would take the boy away, and they do. Immediately regretful, she spends the rest of the night navigating a fantasy labyrinth run by the Goblin King David Bowie, trying to win back her baby brother. She must solve puzzles, survive challenges, make friends, and dance with David Bowie along the way. It's a delightful film filled with fantastic effects, though it probably needs to be seen at a young age to fully appreciate its whimsy, thrills, and horrors.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
So that's kind of where I'm coming from it, is that I'm seeing this now and thinking, like, I bet this would have really impressed me as a kid. I like it now, but that's it, really.
Yeah, I'm kind of just like, yeah, a really cool-looking film. And I'm like, that's...
I like some of the songs. Dance, magic, dance!
You've been on, like, a real Bowie kick.
Yeah, I really got into his music last year, as I talked about on the show last week.
If you did see it when you were younger, it's one of those films you would nag your parents to play over and over and over again for you. It really is.
It also came out during a time of, like, kind of dark children's fantasy movies.
Oh, yeah, the 80s films.
Yeah, but all those 80s fantasy movies are amazing.
No, yeah, it's just, like, for some reason, it was like they all had to be, like, scary.
What was the 80s?
Yeah, the 80s is a scary decade.
The world ended in the 80s. We are now living in the post-apocalypse.
That is depressingly astute. Dave, I'm glad that you have brought that to our attention.
Well, I think about it, it's like, even movies that are supposed to be, like, fun family pictures have this darkness about them.
This veneer of depression.
Now I'm sad. Thank you.
But Aaron, cheer up, we're reviewing Labyrinth.
That's from the 80s!
And I gotta say...
It matters.
Bowie has such an amazing presence.
Oh, definitely.
When has he never...
I was thinking about this earlier.
I mean,
earlier.
Is that
it's
what
like,
it's called nowadays?
He does a lot of, like, weird sort of, like, fantasy and sci-fi stuff, and always did. But he was, like, never considered, like, nerdy, because he was way too cool.
Well, actually, that's where you have to understand some of the importance of the film to anyone who watched it as a little kid, and actually remembers it as a lot of people's first introduction to David Bowie.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he banked a lot off this. New fans?
Like, it was only years later, after seeing this, that, you know, I started listening to Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders of Mars and stuff like that, and really discovered the music. But this was like, oh my God, we could all be like David Bowie, because he's that much of a snaggletooth freak, but he's amazing. Of course you'd want to be like him.
He has this incredible level of charisma that's also a very non-typical charisma.
True. He does what he wants, when he wants to, and you know what? If he's doing it, it must be right, because it's David Bowie.
I was listening to Adam Savage talk about David Bowie on his podcast, and one of the things he said that really stuck with me is that while there's a lot of people who come off and do a lot of weird stuff like Lady Gaga or any of that stuff, with a lot of them it feels forced, and with David Bowie, managed to do it with a sense of honesty about it.
Oh, yeah, it seems very natural from him.
Yeah, do you think maybe it's like, you were talking about how, like, you know, he was into all this, like, sci-fi and fantasy stuff, but, like, no one really saw him as a nerd, but do you think, like, he actually was really into
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, like he was like a nerd at heart, so he loved this stuff, so he did what he loved, as opposed to these other people that are just doing it because they know it'll attract attention.
And he was also a fan of, like, really weird music that a lot of other people didn't like the Velvet Underground and early Pink Floyd with Syd Barrett.
He caught that stuff early. And then everyone else started paying attention to it because David Bowie paid attention to it.
And because of the whole Velvet Underground connection with the Andy Warhol, it's like he wasn't just into music, but he was into art and music and philosophy and all these things and the whole science fiction fantasy characters that came out of him were a product of his interests.
I'd actually like to eventually get a copy of the soundtrack of Labyrinth.
Yeah, Dave.
It's a good soundtrack.
You're gonna get the vinyl, Dave, to add to your
you should get collection.
I would like some Bowie vinyl. I don't know if I would start with the Labyrinth. I really want to get Station to Station.
I could see that. So anyways, the Labyrinth.
There is that fantasy storytelling aspect that always kind of just throws me off, where it's like there is an end goal, but from the start of the adventure to the end, it's filled with, like, just a series of challenges.
It's just the idea of a quest. The ancient concept of a quest.
The hero's journey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you don't necessarily want to do something, but you're forced into a situation where you have to. And it's ridiculous and outlandish and has a bunch of components that make no sense whatsoever. But you gotta go through it anyways to reach the end, save the girl, save the baby, save yourself from David Bowie's crotch, and survive and get back home to that normal mundane life that you're supposed to be idolizing.
But to a certain level, I feel like there's almost a disconnected, like, series of segments. They're starting and stopping, starting and stopping. You know, it's like this challenge, we face that challenge, get through, and then we're in a new place, there's a new challenge, and so it's like, constant. I don't know, it's like I've tried to read fantasy literature and that's what wears me down about it.
You kind of have to just go with whatever is currently happening in a story.
It doesn't feel restrained by explanation.
Actually, Dave, curious here. In a lot of ways, the classic center of that common element, a lot of times referred to as the hero's journey, is also what a lot of Star Wars is based around. Do those elements bother you at all in that?
With Star Wars, there's just this momentum to it. Whereas, like with Labyrinth, there each challenge and, oh, it's another new weird character. But in Star Wars, it's like the threat is always the Empire. It's not like the threat is different each time. Sometimes there's a snow beast that they have to deal with for a moment, but the real threat is always the Empire.
You know?
And there's a momentum of escalating stakes. Like in the Labyrinth, there's the overarching goal, the stake of getting back the baby brother. But then in these little moments, she's solving puzzles that have their own isolated stakes that are disconnected to getting her brother back, except for that she has to go through them to get to that point.
I think I might disagree. I feel like, yes, there's all these isolated moments in the Labyrinth, don't get me wrong, but it is all Jared's Labyrinth. Yes, that's David Bowie's name in the movie. He actually has a character name as Jared.
It's Jared or Jareth?
Jareth.
I was going to say, it's not the guy from Subway.
Yes, it's it's not Subway's favorite pedophile. It's David Bowie stealing a child. Anyways.
Completely different.
So it is obstacles that are all part of
his labyrinth. He says it's his labyrinth.
It's also kind of where you're getting a taste for just the flavor of this world and exploring it, too.
Yeah, it is much more about exploring the world. Star Wars, Empire, and, well, at least Star Wars and Empire, Jedi gets into that sort of world exploring with the Ewoks and stuff, and then I'm actually not a fan of Jedi. This is a point of contention with me and Lucas.
Wait, hold on. When have we ever fought over Jedi?
Oh, we disagree on it. I don't like it. I don't think it's... I think it's one of the weaker movies.
No, I agree.
And you like it.
I think the first half is great, and I love the space battles, but I think the stuff on the land, it just kind of...
Lucas, I think Dave is trying to start a fight with you. You should kick sand in his eyes.
Even in the original Star Wars, you have a little bit of wandering around after droids, sand people, trash compactor monsters, yet you have some obstacles that are not necessarily the Empire. Well, so it sounds like it's mostly the momentum.
Well, don't those moments in Star Wars build on each other towards the final? I think that's what Dave's trying to get at. Is that
yeah,
what
you're saying? Well, yeah, Star Wars, it doesn't feel like it's stopping and starting.
It feels like there's more build.
And the threat is pursuing them a lot.
Well, true.
Jared just kind of watches and then pops up whenever.
But I think there's a lot in Labyrinth where there is momentum. There is, she's pretty much gathering friends around her to help her get through the Labyrinth. And help her succeed at different tasks. She wouldn't have been able to get through certain portions of the labyrinth if it wasn't for the friends that she had made earlier on, like Ludo or...
I do like Ludo.
Yes.
Ludo's sad.
Ludo's sad.
Aw.
It's pretty good Ludo.
Having... I can't now, really completely remember not having seen the movie. So I am coming from a place of every moment is very familiar, and it's like, oh, these guys again, oh, those are fun characters, or there's no part where I'm ever like, oh, what on earth is going on here, because it is all very familiar.
Yeah, I'm sitting there, and there's this guy who shows up with a bird on his head,
yes,
and I'm just like, okay, whatever this thing is now. And then these things that can take off their heads and throw them around, it's just like, which I found incredibly annoying. That was just like, okay, it's the next what the fuck thing. Where it was just like another random thing being thrown out. If I had watched
just
as a kid, I probably would have accepted these things easier and wouldn't have been dissecting the structure of it so much.
If you do get around to watching it a second time, I'd be interested to hear your impressions on a second view through, actually, as well.
The bad green screen is what threw me off in that scene.
Oh
the terrible green screen from 1986.
Back in the day, that was
bleeding edge technology, man.
Many, many of them as a small child, so I really don't analyze it anymore.
With the Labyrinth 2, as opposed to, say, Star Wars, I don't know why this became a Star Wars Labyrinth comparison.
Because I'm curious, because you mentioned it as
it's all your fault, Lucas.
In terms of fantasy structure. I was curious about...
Well, there is also that element of I will accept things in science fiction way easier than I will accept things in fantasy.
Because you've had more exposure. That was partly what I was curious about, Dave, is just getting your thoughts on that structure in something that was not fantasy and
but
seeing
But there's
how
also that thing in Star Wars, there is a grounded logic. Of they're saying, we're going to go to this place, and then we're going to go here, and then we're going to get on this ship, and we're going to go over here. They don't fall asleep, have this fantasy where they're in a crystal ball, wake up in a junkyard somehow. It's like...
Lots of fantasy stories do have that logic involved.
Completely thrown out the window does sort of make me go, well, what's the point?
It is possibly less logical than typical fantasy. It depends. Some fantasy has more grounded logic with specific goals and some doesn't. She didn't really fall asleep, though.
Yeah,
she was
drugged at one point.
Oh,
with the peach.
That was later. I was thinking at the beginning. But yeah, that was kind of a weird segment, because it was very obviously constructed to be her room and was fucking with her head. It was bizarre.
I don't know. I frankly have less of an issue with fantasy pulling all these weird hat tricks than I do science fiction, because science fiction, it is supposed to have a grounding in science, except usually the science they decide to ground it in is terrible and BS. They're just making up stuff. They're supplanting magic with something that's supposed to actually exist, but it doesn't exist. They fail. They fail horribly. I don't know. I'm the opposite.
I will admit that a lot of times and things I've been exposed to as an adult, it really does help my suspension of disbelief when, even in fantasy, there are specific rules for how magic's supposed to work or how the world works.
As long as it's consistent with its own logic. If they say, when we push this button,
because once you embrace
what it comes down to, if it has a consistent logic, fantasy and science fiction, pretty much the only difference between them at that point is structure.
I do quite enjoy the whimsy of Labyrinth, but I really can't imagine what it would be like to see it for the first time as an adult.
I'm just not a fan of... I don't hate the Labyrinth. I find it very enjoyable. I just don't love it. I only like it.
All right. No, I understand that. Well...
Well, that was no U-turns at the drive-in. Thanks for listening to this episode.
Actually, from both of you, what were your favorite and least favorite moments or aspects?
Well, even though the fantasy logic, I was arguing about that, I actually did like the imagery and how it was sometimes disorienting, and they played with perspective sometimes. There's this one great shot at the end when David Bowie turns back into the owl, where it's like he throws up this cloak, and it becomes like feathers. And it's impossible to describe. I like the craft of the puppets and stuff, but it was actually like a lot of like merging of blending images together in this somewhat disoriented but also very artistic way that I really enjoyed the most in this film. Especially the ballroom scene. It's like, it's completely disorienting, but there's something beautiful about it.
Yeah. There was just so much artwork that went into this. This was, some of the best artwork to ever have been created, in my opinion, from Brian Froud, who did a lot of the original design on this and a bunch of other Henson works, I believe. Brian Froud's famous for drawing these gnomes and goblin-type creatures.
Oh, yes, and it was actually his child is the child in the movie.
Yes. So it was his baby being stolen by goblins. But let's face it, when you're the child of Brian Froud, you've already been taken a long time ago.
And he grew up to work in special effects and sculpture and stuff.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think he ended up making a movie with, I want to say, one of Jim Henson's children. Daughter, son, I think a daughter of Jim Henson that was done in the same style as Labyrinth. I haven't seen the movie yet. Puppets, goblins, fun stuff.
Let's see here.
I also really thought the hands segment was great with the hands forming faces.
Up or down?
She chose down?
She chose down!
Lessons learned.
Yes.
It's a short.
That'd be the one. I haven't seen
it yet. So, Lucas, what was your, takeaway or highlight?
The art direction, as you've already been discussing. I love the puppet work. I love the sets and the scenery. That's what I really enjoyed from this movie. I think the downside for me, I didn't think the acting was that great.
Jennifer Connelly I found to be very stagey.
Yeah.
In fact, in the beginning, when she's supposed to be in the real world, and she's acting like she's in a play. I'm just like, this is clashing. But then all of a sudden she turned around and, oh, there's a goblin maze.
Yeah.
Now her acting makes sense.
But then, like, she still, like, deliver lines pretty flat. There was not really any emotion to anything. It was just, hey.
I think there was a little bit of a development, though, with that.
I don't know. Even Bowie was just, he didn't feel like in his full game to me. I don't know.
I think there was a development in Jennifer Connelly's character, though, because, yeah, it was a little bit wooden when she first delivered those lines, and then later on, when she's re-delivering those same lines to David Bowie at the end of the Goblin Maze, trying to figure out everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you understand at the beginning when she's delivering this, she's trying to become an actress.
Yes. And now she's trying to save her little brother.
Right, the motivation is completely different.
I mean, it could be a little bit half-hearted if you're just trying to save your brother from David Bowie. I suppose that makes sense, but...
Bowie, I think, does well as, like, the spoiled child king.
Oh, definitely.
Putting Bowie on screen, you've already done something right.
Yes.
Because he's Bowie.
You know, it's strange, because you've talked to me about the fact that there's a lot of musicians out there that, when they get translated to the silver screen, end up having a real problem with their acting.
Because they can't break their rock star persona.
Yes.
But his rock star persona blends perfectly into character play because that's what a lot of what he did.
I believe, yeah, a lot of what he did was just an expression of art, so this was just an extension of that. This was another personality from Tahib.
And the fact that he reinvented his personality all the time is also to his credit, because a lot of rock stars, they get locked into a personality, and that's why they can't act, because they can't break from that.
Yes.
They develop this stage persona, and then they kind of do it even when they're not trying to do it.
But, I mean, David Bowie was a goddamn chameleon when it came to that kind of stuff, so.
And a lot of good actors are good at putting themselves into new roles, adopting new personality types.
Yeah.
Oh, George Lucas was an executive producer on this movie.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No.
It's in the poster.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, a lot of the early Henson films, LucasArts did so much of the visual effects for a lot of these kinds of
films. A lot of the people who worked on this worked on Empire.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
There is definitely a huge connection there.
So I didn't take us quite as off topic as I thought.
What I like is the screenplay was written by Terry Jones from Monty Python.
Oh, that makes sense.
He would just like look at the art. He'd be trying to construct the story from the ideas that Jim Henson had, and he had all this art, and he just like, okay, there's a creature, I will write an encounter with this creature. You know, that's the next thing. And he came up with the hands thing, just, and they elaborated on that and turned it into what it is.
Nice.
So it's like, they had their ideas and their art, Terry Jones would come up with ideas from their ideas and art, and then they would expand, and that's how Labyrinth was created.
In a lot of respects, I guess you could say that this movie wasn't very rigid in its creation, but just sort of grew. Which makes sense, because that's how you get all the weirdest films.
Do you guys remember the very first time you saw this movie?
Yeah.
No.
As I was saying earlier, it was when I was 9, and my main impression from that first time was just being upset at this idea of a baby brother being stolen away.
Luckily you had a clone.
Because being young enough that I was actually capable of finding it, like, actually mildly threatening at the time, which is sort of hard to imagine as an adult watching.
Aaron, do you remember the second time you saw it?
I don't remember the first, second, or 25th time I saw it, because they were all probably under the age of 10.
Yeah, I don't really remember much about early times watching it. This was one of the most important films of my childhood. This is within the, like, the top, that group of, like, 4 or 5 movies that my siblings and I watched over and over and over again. I can't necessarily say why that was, but it was one of those movies that we really loved. And
wait, did we accidentally make a passion episode?
Yes.
Sorry.
Well,
this is a passion episode.
It wasn't accidentally on my end.
Oh.
Yeah, Dave was texting us about it.
Yeah, because he was telling me about getting you on for a different Muppet movie.
He mentioned Muppet Treasure Island as well.
Yeah.
We might do that in the near future.
I am also
Although
fond
I just
of
learned that this guy never saw a childhood movie of mine, which also Jim Henson was responsible for, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well, it's like all the visual effects of that time were done by Lucas Entertainment, and all the practical effects, if you wanted good ones, were done by Henson. So
now, there were tons of practical effects, depending. If for a children's film, practical effects, you're probably looking at Henson, although they really did Ninja Turtles as an independent project. The studio was not backing that, and that's part of the reason
what
it turned out as interesting
on?
As it is.
They both worked on Willow, too, right?
Yeah. They both worked on Willow.
There are a ton of practical effects studios
that
were working in the 80s.
Lucas Entertainment and Henson Productions worked on so many films together. It was so ridiculous.
So, Cal, why is this movie important to your childhood? And why has it played a role in your direction as becoming going to like art school and stuff? Like, did it get you involved in the creative arts in some manner? How has this movie shaped you personally?
I'm not entirely sure. It's just one of the childhood favorites I grew up with. Definitely has a lot of great imagery. I mean, I do find the puppets and practical effects interesting.
You've made puppets.
But I'm not sure exactly how it's necessarily affected my life. That's a difficult one there. I don't necessarily always...
You like costumes and fantasy art and stuff.
That's true. And I think I'm a bit more open to the fantasy genre than you are, Dave, partly because I had a lot of exposure as a kid.
I'm on the far side of the average person biased against fantasy.
So I guess probably was beneficial for the suspension of disbelief kind of aspect when exploring new stories.
One thing I always appreciate is in a movie is a book. That there's a book that is some way connected to the movie, or the telling of the story. In this, there's the book Labyrinth, which is a book or a play that she's reading that has all the stories and ideas in it. Another book movie would be something like The Princess Bride, where the story is being...
Is there an actual book that this was related to? I actually have no clue.
No, this was
He's talking about books within the movie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, man, there was a bunch of movies then. Never-ending Story.
Yeah.
I like that device.
Never-ending Story was fun, too.
I mean, you don't get many movies that are just made as movies, never been anything of any other media before at this point. You don't get that often. Original content doesn't really sell much. Producers aren't willing to throw their weight behind it, usually. They want proof that somebody's gonna go and see this film.
Yeah, they haven't met
me
yet.
The thing about that, though, a lot of times they're making movies of a lot of things off the bestsellers list, but not all things that are good books translate well into films. There's a lot of very forgettable movies that are based on very well-written books. It's not always like that. There are some great movies based on novels as well, but...
I particularly find it interesting when the book and the movie are completely different, and yet both are good.
I'm sorry, I'm having a moment because I read Jurassic Park recently, and I feel the need to complain about that book. I liked it, but I feel the need to complain about it. I'll catch up with you later about that.
Yeah, I don't think we can even
We don't
that's
have
relevant.
The time to even go
oh, yeah,
near
yeah,
that
I have
right
things
now.
To say about the Lost World book, but...
So trying to move back on track.
I saw The Dark Crystal last year, and I actually enjoyed that a lot more than The Labyrinth.
I haven't watched that one for... It's been longer. I should watch that one again. I did watch that as a kid, too.
Here's a question. Do you feel like it's easier to accept Muppet-like characters if they exist in a vacuum of only Muppet-like characters, or do you find them harder to accept if there's human people-type people kicking around with the Muppet-type characters?
No, I just like the story of Dark Crystal better.
Oh.
I have a sort of related question.
Okay.
Do you hate the movie Wizard of Oz?
Are you aware it was made by a Nazi?
No, I wasn't, actually.
Just the look on your face, Dave, when he asked you that question.
I had no clue it was made by a Nazi. Well, I haven't watched that anytime recently.
It was made by an
either.
Outspoken Nazi sympathizer, who also, when Judy Garland would start to laugh uncontrollably because of some silly thing, and to get her focused, he would just outright slap her in the face.
Oh, my God. No, I was mostly thinking in terms of story structure, having some things in common with some of the things you mentioned
bugging
you. Oh,
The Wizard of Oz is heavily referenced in this, and I saw The Wizard of Oz as a kid, and I like the dark elements of The Wizard of Oz, but I'm no fan of it.
That's why he prefers the Return to Oz.
We will make you act, Judy. We will make you do the dancing!
Oh, no.
Oh, wait.
That's unsurprising.
So anyways.
See, I have no interest in ever watching The Wizard of Oz again.
I haven't watched it for a bunch of years. And yeah, I don't know. I'm not high on
it's
my list
heavily
of
referenced
to re-watch
in this
right
movie,
now.
Though.
But
it's not the first Wizard of Oz
I
movie
like
either.
I like Labyrinth much more.
No, there was a bunch of silent shorts that were The Wizard of Oz. And Alice in Wonderland
shorts.
Actually,
I saw the live Broadway show more recently. That was fun.
You see, that's the other thing. Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland, you know, I just assumed the people that made them were high.
I like Alice in Wonderland,
too. I just thought they were bad laudanum dreams.
All right, I may, like...
But they were still entertaining.
Well, then you have Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. There are some really crazy film adaptations of that from, like, back in the day.
Yeah.
I was flipping through channels once, and all of a sudden I came off this one, I'm like, what is this pagan ritual movie? And I looked at the guy, and it was Midsummer's Night Dream.
I don't think I've ever seen a movie of that. I've seen play versions of it.
I've seen
live
like,
multiple times,
it.
But weird, I don't think like, I've actually seen a film of it.
It was
and white movies that are just very strange.
Of course, they can get away with it because it's Shakespeare. Anyways, The Labyrinth.
So there are definitely things that stick with you in this movie. That, you know, characters, songs, quotes. I asked you what if you had any quotes, and you just did it.
Instead of looking through stuff.
Hey.
Yeah. Ah, my phone.
Dance, magic,
put that wicked spell on me. Slap that baby, set him free. Oh.
I saw my baby crying hard as babe could cry. What could I do? My baby's love and gone.
Stop, we can only use 5 seconds for that.
What?
Now we'll have to pay royalties.
Oh!
Damn you.
We have a bit too much of that memorized. We've watched it, a lot of times.
So you've watched this movie not only as children, but together.
As adults?
Oh, yeah.
A few times.
I think I've only watched it with you once or twice, I don't know.
Maybe two or three times.
Mostly watched it as... lots of times spread out throughout my life. It's just, you know, there.
Is there a certain mood you're in when you want to come back to this movie?
Sometimes you just need to watch The Labyrinth, Dave.
Some movies have that classic movie status, largely from early childhood exposure, I think. For me, it's movies like Labyrinth, like The Princess Bride, some other cases as well. But you remember seeing Star Wars as a kid.
Yes.
I mean, it is hard for me to analyze it in a similar way if, you know, the original Star Wars, there's plenty I take for granted because it's deeply ingrained in my childhood. It's one of those important classic movies to me mentally, even though it very well may not be to the rest of the world because it was so very much a part of my childhood. And I guess in some ways that's part of where parents influence their kids' psychological development, I'm sure, because all kind of the variety of movies and books you're exposed to as an early age probably have some impact on psychological development. And
I know there are some movies that I watched as a kid, and when I go back and watch them, it's like centering or something. It like brings me back to this happy place, you know?
Yeah,
it's a part of the world that makes sense. Whether or not it should make sense.
Like, if I'm really stressed out, I'll just start, like, watching Godzilla movies or something like that, you know?
It is probably partly a comfort thing. I have some happy memories of just spending time with my siblings on days off, watching some of our favorite movies together, and with friends, introducing them to movies I'd grown up with when they hadn't seen them yet, or rewatching favorite movies. There's definitely a much higher need to rewatch when you're a child.
Oh, yeah.
Admittedly, is probably where some of the weight comes from.
That's weird. You think of children as having the shortest attention span, but they'll watch the same thing over and over again.
Yeah,
and I guess that's where it's important, too, is that I know for a fact that I will watch it again more than once in my life, whereas a lot of times as an adult, there are actually a lot of movies that I'll go in, I'll watch, I'll enjoy, and I will come out knowing that I will be perfectly good with never watching them again in my life.
Yeah, as an adult, it's harder to find movies that are going to just, like, rock your world the same way.
It's fun, It is also, I guess, as a childhood favorite, a movie that is beyond the need to overanalyze for me, which really, a lot of times when I watch new films, I do analyze them a lot. But the childhood favorites are sort of beyond the reach of that to a large extent. Nothing in them is going to bother me because I've seen them a ton of times and could just go back to that world.
And this is a movie you're also going to continue to share with people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you hear someone hasn't seen it, it's... I mean, imagine hearing someone say they haven't seen Star Wars, which somehow there's still people out there that will have to fix that one person at a time somehow.
Yeah, there are some people who tell me they haven't seen a movie, and I'll just be like, what?
Yeah, you and Megan went off on me yesterday about Ninja Turtles.
Yes.
So,
okay, so back into the conversation.
Back to Labyrinth somehow.
Yeah, like, I have kids. I probably won't show them Wizard of Oz, just because I don't want to ever watch it again, but I'd definitely show them Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'll, if I get to that, probably think very, very carefully on what I wouldn't get driven insane by having to watch repeatedly. Mm-hmm. So Labyrinth would definitely be on the list.
So when I have children, I'm going to just start working through all the films I love, like Time Bandits and...
oh my god, Time
Bandits. Stuff like that.
I definitely will be, like, banning Lady Snow Hawk. White from the house, because...
Lady Hawk.
You think it would be okay to... I think I saw Lady Conan the awesome. Barbarian when I was young. I think it'd be okay to show that to kids.
Cal?
I mean...
I'd have to rewatch it again. I've only seen Conan once.
People laugh at Arnold Schwarzenegger's Conan as actually a really good movie.
I hope he gets to do Conan again. I honestly do. He is the quintessential film version of Conan.
I think some of the least child-appropriate parts were actually in your commentary and not in the film, so it might be
alright. Possibly. We riffed on that film, making it far more inappropriate than ever was.
That was amazing. I wish we'd been recording that.
The only person that could make Arnold Schwarzenegger having sex with a demon witch worse is you, Dave. Let's just face this.
Yeah, I have never riffed so well as I did that night.
You were spot on. That was marvelous.
I could never repeat that.
That's why it's so sad we weren't recording.
It is a shame.
So yeah, all of these classic 80s fantasy films, we should make them watch Legend as well. Because we need Tim Curry as the devil. And unicorns.
Unibrow.
Have you seen that one?
And unibrow cruise, yes.
At some point, he started dealing with the unibrow. If you haven't seen that, I think it would bug you.
I haven't seen it. It would bug me.
It would. It's another movie that has beautiful imagery, but the plot is even
you would
more...
hate this film,
it doesn't
Dave.
Make sense. It isn't as good as Labyrinth, and it definitely... the attempts at storytelling, or lack thereof, would probably drive you nuts.
I gotta actually compile a list of, like, good films I can tolerate. If I ever get to the point of having children, that's a list I have to compile. And I might need help, because I don't think I know a lot. Because if it was a matter of showing kids my favorite movies...
You would be dealing with kids with chronic nightmares?
Probably. Some kid who twitches whenever Kurt Russell is mentioned.
Oh.
It's like, Captain Ron? No!
Well, Lucas?
Send him on the way. Well, Jelly Folk, thank you for listening to this episode of No U-Turns at the Drive-In. We're your hosts, Lucas and...
Dave, with our special guests...
Aaron and Cal.
If you enjoyed this episode, may I suggest you go to our website at psychojellyfish.com to find this and other podcasts. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes and the podcast app Stitcher. Please rate and review. It really does help with the show. If you're a fan, you want to help spread the madness, give us a like at facebook.com/psychojellyfish or follow us on Twitter at Jellycast. Any thoughts, words, comments, questions? Send them our way in the comment section.
Good night, gentle listeners.
Keep it psycho.
I keep trying to say with my co-host, but co-host is not coming out right.
I am your co-host.
But I keep forgetting to say the word co-host. I keep saying other host.
That other guy.
You're the other guy, Lucas.
Okay.
How does your computer feel about that?
I think the computer feels kind of betrayed, to tell you the truth.